Welcome to Axis, Utah. In the early 1940s, Helmut Huebner, a Mormon teenager, decided to leave Hitler's youth and confront the Nazi regime and his church leaders. Eventually, he was excommunicated from his church and became one of the youngest opponents of the Third Reich to be executed. We'll examine the conflict of conscience occasioned by, among Mormons, by the extreme circumstances of the Third Reich, and consider the question articulated by German novelist Günter Grass: why did Huebner know and I didn't know? Our guest for the hour will be Alan Kiel, Professor Emeritus of German Studies at Brigham Young University. He gave a talk recently on the USU campus titled Mormons and Nazis, The Case of Helmut Huebner. We'll also hear excerpts from a documentary film on the subject, Truth and Conviction, which was shown at the LDS Institute of Religion recently. These events were part of a symposium series on the Holocaust presented by the USU Religious Studies program. And Professor Kiel, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm flattered to be here.
You were educated at Princeton.
A PhD at Princeton, yeah. I was a student at the U. Then I transferred after my LDS mission to Brigham Young University.
And taught German studies?
And then I was hired back at BYU after I got the PhD and taught German, what we're now calling German studies, but I did everything from opera libretti as literature to war and peace studies, and also taught German language and literature. So.
And you've written a book on the Huebner case.
Yeah, several actually. I did my dissertation on a post-war German writer, and that made me kind of a specialist in post-war German works. So I began reading all of the things I could get my hands on, including Günter Grass. And by the time I came back to BYU in 71, I had gotten to a novel called Local Anesthetic, which had been published just 2 years before. I was just a couple of years behind by that time. And in this novel, I encountered, to my surprise, this young Mormon figure, Helmut Huebner. And as a Mormon myself, I thought, gosh, how come I don't know about this? And so I did a little research and found the original article that had appeared in a small newspaper that Grass had found, which gave me the names of some of the co-conspirators. And I was sitting in my office one day, and the snowflakes were falling outside like a Grimm's fairy tale. And I suddenly thought, I wonder if any of these people emigrated. So I grabbed the Salt Lake phone book, and lo and behold, they had all emigrated for all practical purposes. I was sitting at the source of these of this historical research. So I sort of abandoned my role as German literary scholar for a few days, and I thought it would be a few days. It actually has kind of dogged me my whole career. And we began to call people up. I called up Carl Schnibbe. And he said to me, I've been waiting 25 years for this call. And he was very happy to tell me his story and also his friend Rudy Vobbe.
And as we go along, we'll find that these are two companions of Huebner's in this.
That's right.
What came to be known as the Huebner Group. Let's set the scene, and then we'll hear a clip. We're going to be hearing clips from this documentary film, Truth and Conviction. So the rise of Hitler, and of course, we're seeing this in hindsight. But so it's kind of hard for us to see, but there was an attraction to Hitler for a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, we have to remember that, and I'm not trying to sound like I'm an advocate of Hitler, but you know he put people back to work. There was enormous unemployment in Germany after World War I, after the embarrassment of the Treaty of Versailles, huge inflation, hyperinflation. Of course, people didn't always ask for the backstory. They didn't care if they got a job somewhere, if this was in the armaments industry or if Hitler was building the Autobahn so that he could have his tanks move back and forth more rapidly and so forth. I think H.L. Mencken said it's very hard for a man to understand something if his income depends on his not understanding it. But there were enthusiasts for Hitler in Utah and in Great Britain, among the Mormons as well. There was an article or an unsigned editorial in the Millennial Star, which is the LDS Church's official organ in Great Britain, that enthused about Hitler. You know, early on, the man's putting people back to work. He's cleaning up all that nasty graffiti and all those asocial elements. He's got those guys off the streets, you know, and sort of the Roaring Twenties were pretty rough in Berlin, if you watch Cabaret or some of those documents of the time. So there were a lot of people who thought this is a good thing. And among the Mormons, there was also kind of a strange urban folklore that grew up that Hitler had, in fact, visited the Mormon branch when he was a young man living there in Braunau, Inn, where he was born. And some of the folklore even went so far as to say that he joined the church. And he was a teetotaler, and he didn't smoke tobacco, so they thought, you see, that fits. And it's kind of interesting that even the fact that the Mormons could not get access to genealogical archives before Hitler, because they were obviously controlled by the Catholic and Protestant churches, respectively. But after Hitler, they were able to allow free access to the genealogy archives, and they thought, well, this is great. Of course, they didn't see the bigger picture, which was that the Germans had insisted that church archives be now open because people needed to research whether their Jewish grandmother was half Aryan or whatever. It was a nasty kind of ugly reason. But you know, if you were a genealogy researcher and you didn't ask the bigger question, you thought, no, this is great. You know, this Hitler guy, he's okay. So there was a big reason why there was a lot of enthusiasm for Hitler, not only in Germany but in part outside.
And but as time went on and some of these things became more clear, there was some opposition. There are some opposition groups that that grew up. Let's hear a bit from the movie Truth and Conviction. This is directed by Matt Whitaker.
Early in Hitler's regime, there was some opposition among the working class, but soon they too were either supportive or silent.
It was sort of making a pact with the devil, but not knowing that it was the devil that you made the pact with and where that would end up.
As the Nazi police state tightened its grip, there was a struggling underground movement, but relatively few organized resistance groups. In 1942, the White Rose Group, led by college students Hans and Sophie Scholl, disseminated anti-Nazi leaflets. In 1944, Klaus von Stauffenberg and other military leaders made an unsuccessful attempt to assassinate Hitler in an ill-fated bombing. But before these movements had emerged, there was another resistance group forming in the port city of Hamburg. In 1941, a young man named Helmut Hubner led a resistance movement comprised of himself and two childhood friends from his church congregation. Helmut Hubner was 16, Rudolf Wabe was 15, and Karl Heinz Schnibbe was 17. Karl Heinz is the last surviving member of the group.
Most people, they have no idea how it was in Nazi Germany, how dangerous it was in Nazi Germany. To tell the truth was a deadly luxury. My friend Helmut thought that was his Christian obligation to warn the people and tell them what happens.
And that at the end is the voice of Karl Schnibbe. Very
that's
powerful
Karl,
to hear his
Schnibbe,
voice.
Yeah.
He has since died.
He has passed away about 3 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. So these were teenagers in Hamburg. I understand that Kristallnacht really was formative in turning Helmut Hubner against the regime. He had been a member of the Nazi youth, right? Hitler's youth.
Yes, and of course most people were, but he was also a fairly converted, you know, enthusiastic Nazi. We have a school essay of his called the War of the Plutocrats, and this was a typical kind of attack on these U.S. Jewish capitalist Wall Street plutocrats who had started this war. But that changed diametrically when, certain events. Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, in November of 1938 was certainly one. Karl Schnibbe tells us about how shocked he was to see the synagogues in flames and Jewish shops broken. But there were things that happened within the LDS branch that Helmut belonged to, and Karl and Rudy. The branch president was an absolutely 100% enthusiastic Nazi. But you shouldn't be surprised. I mean, this was Nazi Germany, so there were a few Nazis in Nazi Germany. I keep trying to make that point to my students at BYU. They were always horrified and shocked at this fact. I'm not trying to justify it. I'm just saying it happened. And I think some of the behavior of this guy, he, for instance, brought a radio in on Sunday and tried to lock the doors and said, "We're going to listen to the Führer's speeches now." He had a counselor named Otto Berndt who said, no, we're not going to do that. This is not a political organization. This is a Church of God. So we're not actually clear whether he actually did that or he did it once and Berndt wouldn't tolerate it any longer. But he tried to do that, and that was offensive. He also put a sign up on the branch, and this was apparently very completely unique in Germany. No other branch presidents did this, saying Jews are forbidden to enter. This was aimed at one particular member of the branch, a young man named Solomon Schwartz, who at any rate had a Jewish-sounding name, Solomon, and he looked kind of Jewish according to the cliches of the time. No one was actually sure who his father was because his mother had been the victim of a rape when she was a civilian war prisoner and had been in World War I, had been transported over to Romania to Transylvania, which is a German-speaking part of Romania, and had been raped by someone there who she thought was a Jew. The baby was born. She named him Solomon, took him to Hamburg. And it was against this. This sign seemed to have been put up there to keep Solomon out of the branch. He was later denounced by someone and sent to Auschwitz, where he died. His sister, whom I interviewed in Hamburg many years later, was convinced that the branch president, Arthur Sander, had also denounced her brother. And I was always astonished that though she had lived with this terrible wound in her soul for all those years, that she had remained a faithful Latter-day Saint. I think if my bishop denounced my brother to the Gestapo, I think I would have a tough time going back to church, but she proved her faithfulness. But this was the atmosphere. A woman, a sister in the branch, came in one day carrying a leaflet that had been dropped from a British plane, a propaganda leaflet. And Sander ripped that out of her hand and said that he was going to send her to a concentration camp if she ever did that again. Helmut witnessed this kind of thing. I think that tipping point may have come with an older gentleman in the ward there, or in the branch there, whose name was Heinrich Worps. He was walking across a plaza there in Hamburg one day when some statue was being unveiled. And I wasn't cautious and said audibly, and someone heard him say this, "Oh, they're unveiling another statue to another Nazi butcher." And it was taken to a concentration camp, Neuen Gamme, near Hamburg, put in stocks outside in the wintertime. His hands were, water was dripped on his hands, and big gloves, big mittens of ice formed on his hands. And then the SS guard would come by with a rubber truncheon and knock the ice off his hands and would tell him, "Look, this will keep your hands warm." So he was tortured and almost killed in this camp. And finally, when he was released, about a year later, he was a broken man. He came back to the branch and refused to talk about it. But Helmut wouldn't let him go, and he just pestered him until Heinrich Worp finally broke down and told Helmut this story. So at the conclusion of these kinds of, you know, events, it's really no wonder that Helmut became an absolutely determined anti-fascist. But the thing, I guess, that really made it possible for him was that the accidental fact that his older half-brother, had been in occupied France as part of the German work service, had brought back a radio. And I think since we're on public radio now, one of my favorite things in the world, this is important that the radio plays a really important role in this whole story. The German radios at the time were kept purposely primitive. It was called the Volksempfänger, by analogy to the Volkswagen. You know, this is the people's receiver. And that was the people's car. And it could only get the German stations. But this little radio that he brought back from France, it was the brand was Rola, R-O-L-A, and it had a shortwave band. And the brother locked it in a cabinet at his grandparents' house where he lived, and then Helmut went into that room later when his brother was inducted. And he broke open the cabinet, and he apparently replaced one or two tubes that were working in this radio, and he turned it on, and he heard boom, 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 which was, of course, the first notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, but it was also the short, long of the Morse code for V, the letter V for victory, which was Churchill's, you know, you imagine Churchill holding his fingers up in the V shape. So this was the BBC London. And now Helmut really was a confirmed anti-fascist because the news from the BBC London was accurate. He could tell instantly that it was accurate because it was detailed. And it was also fair in the sense that the BBC would honestly tell the world that we had big casualties today too. You know, there was a battle here and there, and the British side lost so many people, and the Germans we think lost so many people. But it was kind of they may have even reported things like, you know, we were defeated today. The Germans beat us. You know, whereas the German news was all sort of rah-rah, and we beat every, you know, nobody died on the German side, and everywhere we go is kind of like someone listening to Kim Jong-un right now, you know. It's hard to believe that was true. So this, I think, was the background of Helmut's ability. Plus, he had he had learned shorthand, so he was able to take down notes from these broadcasts. Also, the branch president, Sander, had entrusted him with a branch typewriter, or a Remington. We even know the serial number of this thing. He'd taken it home to write letters to soldiers on the front at the front from the branch. Because this guy, Sander, I have to say, was a really terrific branch president, given the fact that his political views were extreme right-wing views. He did a great job taking care of the lambs and sheep in his fold. And he told Helmut, who was his sort of secretary, write these letters every week to these people in the front, which Helmut was doing. But he then used that typewriter to, using carbon paper, to prepare leaflets. At first they were little postcard-sized things, but then they became what the Germans called DIN. Forgotten. It's about the equivalent of 8.5 by 11. It's a little longer and a little narrower, but it's about that size. So they're full-size sheets of paper. And they're pretty much without margins. It's so pretty much wall-to-wall print. And they're very brilliantly written. He writes a long doggerel poem in one of them about how Joseph Goebbels is lying when he tells you things over the radio. He quotes Frederick Schiller's Wilhelm Tell in one point. He's kind of showing off a little bit, too. He quotes Hamlet. But these things are quite prescient. When you read them now, you think, wow. And, of course, he was saying things that the BBC was saying. But this was a time when Hitler was really very successful. Everywhere he went, there were no setbacks, really. They were he'd invaded Poland in a few weeks. That was, he invaded Denmark. He was in France. He'd now invaded Russia. In fact, it was interesting that just a couple of weeks after Helmut's trial in August of 42, that the Battle of Stalingrad began. And it wasn't until the Battle of Stalingrad had been underway for a while that it became obvious to everybody that the war had turned and that Hitler was doomed. But before that, it was pretty clear that Hitler was doing, he was succeeding in everything he undertook. So Hubner really was going against the grain here, but he did have the BBC at his back.
We're going to talk more about Helmut Hubner and get into exactly what he did. He distributed these leaflets. He recruited a couple of other young men. These are teenagers in Nazi Germany going up against a very cruel regime. And we'll get into their fate and ask the question articulated by German novelist Günter Grass, a key question: why did Hubner know and I didn't know? There's also a generational after the war, a generational kind of a conflict, wasn't there? That the older people just didn't want to remember. Right. Younger people were curious about it. We'll talk about that as well. We're talking with Alan Keel, who is a professor emeritus at Brigham Young University. He gave a talk at USU recently called "Mormons and Nazis: The Case of Helmut Hubner." And we're hearing excerpts from a documentary film on the subject called "Truth and Conviction." We're treating the case of Helmut Hubner in the early 1940s. He decided to leave Hitler's youth and confront the Nazi regime and his church leaders. Eventually, he was excommunicated from his church, became one of the youngest opponents of the Third Reich to be executed. In this film, we'll be hearing more clips from one of the members of his group, who was a teenager at the time as well. That's Karl Schnibbe. Very powerful to hear his voice. More following the break. We're back with Alan Keel, Professor Emeritus of German Studies at Brigham Young University. He gave a talk recently on the USU campus, part of a symposium series on the Holocaust presented by the USU Religious Studies program. That talk was titled "Mormons and Nazis: The Case of Helmut Hubner." Helmut Hubner was a Mormon teenager in the early 1940s when he decided to confront the Nazi regime. And he was in a Mormon branch headed up by a very committed Nazi. And so there's a conflict within the branch. This is illustrative, I'm sure, Professor Keel, of other churches, other religious people. Let's hear another clip from the film. This sort of sets up this crisis of conscience. Should we be loyal to the government officials? Should we be loyal to God? Where does our conscience fit?
Did Helmut ever think about getting caught, and what would that mean towards the neighbors and towards the other members of the church? I don't know.
The church family was truly a family, as far as the Nazis were concerned. And they had something which they called Sippenhaft. And it meant that if you have some member of your family who is going against the law, that they can arrest your whole family.
In this oppressive climate, religions throughout Germany struggled to find the balance in supporting the Nazi government while upholding their Christian values. Again and again, they were faced with the question, can we be loyal to Hitler and at the same time loyal to God? Though the answer to this question varied within the different denominations, everyone knew the ominous consequences of religious objection to the regime.
So the complexity that is found in every Mormon branch is largely a reflection of this delicate balancing act of being good citizens while at the same time doing all we can personally to bring about the God-given human rights that belong to all people.
And so for Helmut, the issue was, am I not raised to tell the truth and to pass on the truth? And so I think this became a very important issue for him, to tell people what was really happening, what he knew.
So there's a conflict, obviously, within this branch. The branch president is a very committed Nazi, a true believer, It sounds like. Helmut Humber, was he 15 years old, 16?
He was 16 when this kind of broke loose, but he was 17 at the time of his arrest, because they went on about a year without interference.
So what were his motivations?
Well, you know, this question of the choice between loyalty to the state and loyalty to the church and so forth, and to God, is really an important one. And I think it's undeniable that Helmut was, as a young Mormon kid, influenced by the analogy of the LDS missionaries handing out tracts, you know, and telling people that they were here to proclaim the truth to them and so forth. There is a thing in LDS church doctrine called the 12th Article of Faith, which is something that Joseph Smith wrote. It's a very brief statement, and it says that we believe in being subject to kings, magistrates, and others, and to, in obeying and sustaining the law. Joseph Smith was at pains to tell the world that we were not anarchists, that we were not, you know, survivalists who holed up in caves and thought the government was our enemy, although it seems that some of us have gone that direction now that Joseph was gone. And there are other LDS scriptures that deal with this a little more detail. In the Doctrine and Covenants, for instance, section 98, section 134. But it seemed to some of the branch members that this was a simple thing. You know, it doesn't say we believe in being subject to dictators and homicidal maniacs, but they didn't know that at the time, I guess. So it seemed to a lot of them that Hubner had broken the 12th Article of Faith, although I'm not sure one can break an Article of Faith, but never mind. And they were also concerned that he had put them in danger, as my colleague Doug Tobler in the last clip said. The action of these young boys could hypothetically have resulted in the annihilation of all the Mormons in Germany at that time. That was not beyond the pale. Luckily, it didn't come to that. When the investigators from the Gestapo, the secret state police, came to church in their plainclothes spies came into the ward after that, well, what did they find? They found people denouncing Hubner for having gone against the 12th Article of Faith, this stupid kid. I hear this today from older Germans who have not changed their minds about this. Karl-Heinz Schnibbe's sister, to his death, wouldn't speak to him because he'd put them in danger. You know, she belonged to that school. And they saw the Nazi guy up front with his golden party pin and his suit that had a fabric that was made with little swastikas in it. So, one guy stood up in priesthood meeting and said, if I'd knowed he was going against the Führer, I'd have got my gun and killed him. I'm giving him the Southern accent to try to sort of imply that he was a hick, but who knows what he was. His name was Jacoby. I don't know the man, but, you know, to have someone stand up in church and say I would have shot him myself is pretty radical. So the Gestapo people said to themselves, well, okay, there's no problem here. However, they did think that there was an adult behind this group. They couldn't believe that he'd written those things himself. So they suspected this guy, Otto Berndt, you know, who was, you know, I think every LDS ward to this day has some suspected liberal. And so they rounded him up and arrested him and interrogated him for 3 days. And Otto Berndt reports that he just kind of turned this thing over to the Lord and just answered these machine gun fire rapid questions as best he could. And they tried to trip him up, of course, but he was honest and he was sincere. He really didn't know anything about this. And so after 3 days, they let him go. And as they were walking him to the door, he said to them, well, I hope you understand that I didn't have anything to do with this. And they said, listen, Baron, if we had the slightest doubt about this, you wouldn't be going out of this place alive. But make no mistake, they said, when we have this war behind us and we've eliminated all the Jews, you Mormons are next. There's no room in New Germany, in New Hitler Germany, for some American sect like yours. So there was never any doubt on the highest echelons of the Hitler regime that they would let this sect go. And so the Mormons, as the bombing raids increased and as it became obvious that Hitler was going to lose the war, they began thinking, you know, this is a good thing. It's a good thing we're going to lose this war, because our faith in this guy was really ill-placed. And let's pray that Hitler doesn't win the war because of the consequences that they could see.
Let's talk a little bit about, and we're going to play another clip about the arrest. Huebner had this typewriter, and he was typing up these leaflets, which, as you point out, showed that he had some education and showed some bravery as well. Just in the leaflets, he's saying very harsh things about the leadership, including Hitler, and they're distributing. And he recruits these other two young men. And Carl Schnibbe, who we hear in this documentary, who moved to the United States, the Salt Lake area, here he's talking about the arrest. I believe this is Schnibbe. This was occasioned by Helmut Huebner trying to recruit another fellow who didn't accept this, and that leads to their arrest.
Yeah, he had actually recruited another young guy who was at his workplace, who was not a Mormon, a young man named Gerhard Duver, who then got arrested with them all and spent the whole prison, and they had remarkable adventures in these labor camps. They were in one labor camp in Poland in January of 45. They had to walk through across Poland and out of Germany on foot when the Russian armies approached. And we have a diary that this Gerhard Duver wrote. He kept a day-by-day diary of this horrible trek through waist-deep snow in terrible conditions. So we really can't forget to mention Gerhard Duver. But the reason they got arrested was because Helmut got a little more emboldened and tried to recruit yet one more person at his work, a young boy named Werner Kranz. And he was observed trying to hand him a leaflet, and Kranz blew the whistle, and he was arrested.
Here is the clip from the movie, Truth and Conviction.
This young man didn't even read it. He brought it right away to Mr. Mons, you know. And Mr. Mons read it, and while he was reading this, he grabbed the telephone and dialed the Gestapo. You know, and the Gestapo was there 10 minutes later.
It was 5 p.m. on February 5th when the Gestapo arrested Huebner at his work. They took him immediately to his grandparents' apartment, where he was living at the time. There, they found the illegal radio, several flyers, and the typewriter, with an unfinished flyer still in it. He was then taken to the Gestapo headquarters in Hamburg. Here, the interrogations began, as the Gestapo tried to ascertain who else was involved in the conspiracy.
February 10th. I went to work again. There was a knock on the door, boom, boom, boom. And I said to my fellow worker, I said, Willy Forbeck is his name. I said, Willy, I get it. He said, okay. So he went in the room and sat down and started eating, you know. I opened the door and there stood two guys, about 6'4", 6'3", tall, with that long, dark leather coat. And he lifted up his lapel from the coat and there was the badge. Geheime Staatspolizei, Gestapo. He said, are you Karl Schnibbe, Karl-Heinz Schnibbe? I said, yes, I am. He said, you know why we are here? I said, yes, I do. I had said, who, me? No idea. I would get it right away. You just had to look at these guys. I mean, they had feet that big and hands like a toilet seat. I mean, they use it. They know how to use it. We heard story enough how brutal and mean the Gestapo was. I said, yes, I know. He said, come with us. I said, can I change clothes? I had my whites on. He said, you come as you are. I said, okay. So I yelled to Willy. I said, Willy, I have to leave for a minute. He said, okay. Leave for a minute? 7 years. And then they drove me downtown to Stadthaus, where the Gestapo headquarters is. And there the interrogation started.
An interrogation is a very light word. This is one of the Hubner group. Of course, Helmut Hubner, the head of this, Karl-Heinz Schnibbe and Rudi Wölbe. These are Mormon teenagers, and we're talking with Professor Alan Kiel, Professor Emeritus of German Studies at Brigham Young University. He gave a talk recently on the USU campus called Mormons and Nazis, Case of Helmut Hubner, for the USU Religious Studies program for their symposium series on the Holocaust. And we're hearing clips from a movie which was also shown recently on the USU campus, Truth and Conviction, on the Hubner case. Mormon teenagers who decided to defy the Nazi regime, and they knew the consequences could be fatal, and it was in the case of Helmut Hubner. I was struck by Karl Schnibbe, who we hear throughout the film. He said, "I was always scared."
Yeah.
I was always scared, and yet he did it.
Yeah, he was. He was older, also a little older than the others, and it's a universal law, I think, that teenagers don't think anything bad can happen to them. But the older they get, the more I think it has to do with the completion of the development of the frontal lobes or something in the brain. But Carl, being a little older, was always also the one who was a little more frightened about the consequences about it. At least that's how he said it, how he claimed it to be. Nevertheless, he went ahead with it because he too became convinced that the BBC broadcasts were correct, and that the broadcasts that they and the whole propaganda mechanism of the Third Reich was one gigantic lie. And at some point, these graphs crossed; these lines on the graph crossed, and his desire to tell the truth became greater than his fear of the possible consequences. They did sort of have a pact. They said, look, if any one of us gets caught, then he'll deny that the other, he won't say anything about the others. And it appears that Hubner kept his side of the bargain for quite a while. But when you read the transcripts of this, and by the way, this is one of the best documented things. We were astonished to find out how detailed documentation was still available. My colleague Douglas Tobler, whom one hears on the film, a German historian at BYU, had gone to Germany on a sabbatical, and he came back from a visit to the American Document Center in Berlin with this enormous 4-inch thick pile of documents. So we have transcripts of the interrogations, and we know that a lot of the things are euphemisms, like interrogation, So it'll say things like, after a very strong remonstrations, He's like, after we beat the heck out of this kid, he finally said, well, yes, Karl Schnibbe did come over one night and we sort of tried to listen, but we couldn't get it was being jammed that night or something. So he tried to make his friends look as innocent as possible, but eventually they kind of, Gestapo smelled a rat and they arrested both of them. And to a certain extent, Rudy admitted more. But Carl always held back. And for instance, he never took a leaflet home. If he wasn't able to dispose of it, put it in a brief or in a letter box or hang it up on a bulletin board or something, he would burn the thing. He kept a package of matches with him. And consequently, when the Gestapo searched his house, they found nothing. So all in all, it resulted in Carl getting a 5-year sentence. Rudy got a 10-year sentence because he did admit a little bit more. Now, ironically, this stood Rudy in good stead when, at the end of the war, they came through the camp and looked around and said, okay, we need soldiers. Schnibbe, you've served the majority of your 5 years, so you're in the army now. Wölbe, you stay here because you haven't served anything like the first half of your thing. And a couple weeks later, the British liberated Rudy, but Carl was, quote, end quote, liberated by the Russians, and he got to serve another 4 years in prisoner of war labor camps along the Volga. But there was a lot of fear. But there was a lot of boldness, too. But I think the boldness was driven not just by sheer teenage stupidity, though I'm sure that was a factor, but by the insight that the Nazis were really, really, really perpetrating a huge obscenity on the people, and that this had to be somehow countered.
Maybe we can address right here this very important question that Günter Grass asks.
Yeah.
He's paraphrasing just slightly. He said, "How did Hubner know?"
Yeah, how did he know that?
And I didn't know.
Right.
And you could add that to Schnibbe and Wölbe as well.
Right.
That,
yeah.
How did they know? And I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, they knew because Hubner knew. Frankly, they will always admit right up front. They would volunteer that, look, we were so dumb compared to Hubner. They said he was so smart, and he knew this stuff, and he brought us along. But Grass's point is well taken. I have to say to Grass that he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1999. He's a great writer. I mean, he's a troublesome guy. He divides people, and people either hate him or love him. But it turned out that just a few years ago, he shocked Germany by admitting that as a 17-year-old, he himself had been a member of the SS. This is something he'd kept quiet for years, for all those years. And so this question that he asks in the film, we interview him for the film, took on even more significance when it was revealed, when he revealed that he'd been in the SS. Now, let me hasten to say that he didn't join the SS. He was a member of what's called the Waffen-SS. This was an armed, well, all the SS were armed, but it was a military unit, really, that happened to be SS. And they put people, young kids in there at age 17 and put him in a tank, and he was captured by the Americans. But the point is that he says, this has gnawed on me for my whole life. How come Helmut knew this, and how come I didn't know this? Well, the answer was he didn't have the BBC radio, and he didn't have, things had not lined up in a way. Maybe if he'd been there in the ward and had talked to Heinrich Vorps, things would have been better for him. But Grass was one of those many people who bought into this story and was a true believer, to the end. Of course, when he was captured at age 17, he was also wounded somewhat, put in an American re-education camp, and there he was, he sort of indicates in his writings that the American re-educators had to kind of beat him over the head because he was a stubborn, mulish knothead. And but when he became when he was then converted to liberalism, to progressive, social democracy after the war, then he became a fiery advocate for that. He worked closely with Chancellor Willy Brandt. He went probably a little too far. Some of the Social Democrats had to sort of rein him in a little bit. But he was tireless in denouncing people who had been in the SS. He even denounced Ronald Reagan for going to a German military or to a cemetery where some Americans were buried, because also some SS people had been buried there. So when he revealed that he'd been in the SS, he was renounced in some quarters as a huge hypocrite. But Grass is a very consistent and moral thinker. But it's clear that Hübner had a terrific impact on him. And I actually privately think that he eventually decided to confess his early, membership in the SS, if you can call it that, because of this thing with Hübner. Hübner would have opened up. He thought to himself, I really believe that, and I know Grass quite well, so I think I can say that. I can't prove that to anybody, but he was troubled by the fact that he did not know that. This seems like a complete change of topic, but if you jump ahead to the fall of 89, when in East Germany the wall came down, there were this happened in Leipzig. It's so interesting how this happened. In the fall of 89, people started meeting at a certain church in the middle of Leipzig, and they would then go out after the meeting, a brief sermon in the church, and they would go out with candles in their hands, and hold both hands around the candle so it didn't go out, so nobody was throwing rocks. The East Germans were hoping, of course, that somebody would throw a rock through a window so that they can come in and arrest everybody, but they didn't. And this thing swelled. It was like 1,200 and then 1,500, and pretty soon it was 30,000 and 70,000. And finally, in just about 8 weeks' time, it grew to 500,000 people every Monday night. It was brilliantly chosen because they would go right. The stores were closed. That is to say, businesses, offices were closed. People were on the way home. But the stores were still open, so there were still people on the street. There was plenty of reason to allow people to be on the street. And it was Monday night, and that's when the Communist Party had its obligatory sort of staff meetings. So the Communists were gone doing their staff meeting. And on Monday night, there's 500,000 people in Leipzig alone. And, of course, there were others in other cities. East Germany only had like 16 million people. So, I don't know, a quarter of the population, a third of the population at any given Monday night was out on the streets protesting. And they were chanting things like, no violence, keine Gewalt. And what could the government do? It just finally had to open the wall. You can't shoot the entire population of your own country, even if you wanted to, because the army would refuse to shoot, which they did in this case. So my point is that even though Helmut wasn't successful in his time, in overthrowing the regime, he didn't know how many others might join him. And the Nazis were just as concerned that this would catch on as Helmut was, hopeful that it would catch on. They were much more concerned about some guy with a typewriter than some guy with a machine gun. They said, machine gun, we find that all the time. We got lots more machine guns than they do. But typewriters, that scares the heck out of them, because they knew that their whole thing was a house of cards and that the slightest wind of truth could blow it down. Now, it didn't happen then, but I submit that it happened in 89, and that the Germans had learned this important lesson, that you've got to go out on the streets. You've got to put your life on the line, and you've got to say, hey, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And that happened. And all you have to also do is look at the German voting rate. They average around 90% at all kinds of elections, national elections particularly. And our average in the United States, I looked this up again recently, is somewhat under 50%. You know, and that's in presidential elections, and in smaller elections, it's even lower than that. So Germans have learned their lesson. Boy, you can make a political mistake, and 12 years later, you wake up and your country's a smoking ruin, and your kids are going to have to apologize for this for 1,000 years.
Hmm. We're talking with Alan Keel. He's Professor Emeritus at Brigham Young University. He gave a presentation on the USU campus recently called Mormons and Nazis, the case of Helmut Huebner. If you don't know the story, we've been telling story of, obviously, but the story of a Mormon teenager who decided to confront the Nazi regime along with two friends, distributed leaflets. Their hope, as the professor just said, was to disseminate the truth and that would ignite a grassroots movement. And Helmut Huebner became one of the youngest opponents of the Third Reich to be executed. His two friends spent time in a prison camp and immigrated to the United States later. We'll continue telling the story and ask a very important related question. I'm sure, Professor, we'll do this after the break, but there are people who did suspect and who did know and were too afraid to do something. That would probably include many of us, I would imagine. So that question of why did Huebner act and others didn't, we'll treat that following the break. We're back with Alan Keel. He is Professor Emeritus of German Studies at Brigham Young University. He gave a talk on the USU campus recently called Mormons and Nazis, the Case of Helmut Huebner. And that is part of the symposium series on the Holocaust presented by the USU Religious Studies Program. Helmut Huebner, a Mormon teenager, decided in the 1940s to confront the Nazi regime. He eventually became one of the youngest opponents of the Third Reich to be executed. This occasioned a crisis of conscience among, or illustrated a crisis of conscience among many people, religious people. Do we serve the regime? Do we serve God? And there was a division among the LDS branch there in Hamburg. And we're talking with Alan Keel, just a few minutes left in the conversation. Let's treat this very important question, kind of a corollary of Gunter Grass's question, why did Huebner know and I didn't know? In years following the war, the older generation, you know, let's just let this lie. We don't want to know much. The younger generation was curious, wanted to know. You're saying German people did learn some very important lessons from this, which came to fruition in 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall. But I'm sure there were people who suspected, it dawned on them that, this is a house of cards, as you put it earlier, and it's evil. But the Nazi regime was worried about a grassroots movement, and the repression was brutal.
That's exactly right.
And so many people, because of fear, would not act. Why did Huebner act, do you think, and others didn't?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. This is, as time went on, though, this is not a snapshot, but it's a moving picture. And as time went on, as the bombs fell in Germany and as Hitler began to lose and the people could see this was not going to have a good outcome, their faith in the Führer and all that stuff began to crumble. But within the Mormon community, and I like that because it's a microcosm, you can slice it and dice it and look at it a little more carefully. I would say that it represented the macrocosm. There were people on both extremes. There were fanatical Nazis on one end, and I don't think there were any more among the Mormons than there were among the general population as a percent. But there were also Helmut Huebner, so we have at least one, thank goodness. I want to say something just briefly about this so-called excommunication. He was excommunicated, but only by this one branch president, who, however, did get the support of a fellow Mormon and a Nazi named Anton Hook, who at that time was a counselor in the mission presidency after all the American missionaries had left. So he and Anton Hook excommunicated Hubner. But I think it's very important to notice that right immediately after the war, when a Swiss citizen, Mormon named Max Zimmer, got in and found out what had happened, and he communicated that to the First Presidency of the Mormon Church, that they added a notation to his permanent membership record that says, excommunication done by mistake, reinstatement ordered by the First Presidency on this and this date. I've seen that document with my own eyes, and it's impressive. So I know some anti-Mormons who've used this against the church, who said, so the Nazis killed him, but then the Mormons excommunicated him. Well, no, one Mormon branch president excommunicated him. I think the church as a whole would never have excommunicated him. But it does show this problem. There were people, of course, who began to see that Hitler was a real evil. But then at that point, the question is, what can you do? Ironically, our unlimited air war against Germany, though it was intended to shorten the war, may have actually prolonged the war, because it kept people so occupied with survival that there was really not much they could do to do anything. They were running to air raid shelters and just trying to keep their body and soul together. And it tends to disrupt life, yes. Did it disrupt the ball bearing factories? Possibly, but not much. But it did disrupt any further attempts at resistance. So in that sense, there were probably more people who would have joined in some kind of a wider resistance movement. But at that point, bombs were raining on them, and there's not much you can do. You couldn't have gone out on the streets every Monday night safely in Leipzig at that point. Certainly not in Dresden. It was firebombed. Or Hamburg, for that matter. So I want to set that record straight on the excommunication. I think it's quite important to put excommunication in quotation marks.
Yeah, that's an important point. Eventually, we've told a bit of the story of Karlheinz Schnibbe and Rudi Volba, but the leader of the group, Helmut Hubner, eventually was sentenced to death, and interestingly was executed by guillotine. The Nazi regime used this.
People didn't know about that very much, but they did happen to have a guillotine at that spot. My wife and I, Linda and I, were invited last fall, because it was the 70th anniversary of his beheading on the 27th of October, 1942. And we participated in a wreath-laying ceremony there at the prison just at Plötzensee, on the outskirts of Berlin, where he was executed. And the place is still there. I found a couple of really remarkable documents in what was called the Institute for Marxism and Leninism in East Berlin when it still existed. And these are pieces of boilerplate that the regime had pre-printed with spots in there where you could write in the name and the time and so forth. And these documents in our book here are document numbers 60, 61, and 62. They say things like, at this, we, the undersigned officials of the Attorney General, went to Plötzensee prison today, on the 27th of October, at about 1:05 p.m. We sought out in his cell the individual condemned to death, and there's a space, and they'd written in the name Helmut Hubner. And the leader of our team declared to the condemned, who was guarded by two prison officers, that he was going to be excommunicated that night after 8 o'clock.
Executed.
Mm-hmm. Executed, yeah. Did I say executed? Yeah.
Yeah.
Recommended he prepare himself for his final hour, and they pointed out that he could direct his final requests, if any, to the prison officials. So we have this boilerplate document. Then right after that, we include in our book here the letter from Helmut Hubner. He wrote three letters, one to his mother and dad, and he didn't like his stepfather, Hubner. By the way, his name wasn't ever Hubner until just a few weeks before his arrest. So ironically, his mother married this guy, and the guy adopted him, but he wrote one to his grandparents. Both those letters were destroyed in the great firestorm and the bombing raid on Hamburg. But he wrote one to Sister Maria Sommerfeld, and she was another person who had emigrated to Utah. And I interviewed her. She lived on South Temple. And she'd kept the letter. Actually, she'd lost a paper copy of it, but she said, it's engraven on my heart, and I wrote it down again after I'd lost it. And it says, "Dear Sister Sommerfeld and family, when you receive this letter, I will be dead. But before my execution, I have been granted one wish, to write three letters to my loved ones." And then he goes on to say that he's very thankful to my Heavenly Father that this agonizing life is coming to an end this evening. I could not stand it any longer. Anyway, My Father in heaven knows that I have done nothing wrong. I am only sorry that in my last hour I have to break the word of wisdom. Evidently, they were going to give him some schnapps to dull his senses. I know that God lives and he will be the proper judge of this matter until our happy reunion. In that better world, I remain your friend and brother in the gospel. Helmut, so that's a very touching letter. And then there's this other piece of boilerplate that happens at 8 o'clock that night. They go into the cell. They take him down to the director of executions. At 8:13 p.m., the condemned man appeared with his hands shackled behind his back. Two prison guards escorted him into the room, locking the door behind them. They identified the guy, made sure it was the same one, with his shirt. And it says the prisoner showed no resistance when he was placed before the guillotine. They laid him down on his stomach. Now, this is all pre-printed, though, so we don't know if he actually resisted or not. But with his shirt removed, he was placed upon the apparatus, and the executioner removed the head from the body of the condemned man with the guillotine. And this is gruesome now, he says. He then reported the sentence carried out. The procedure took 10 seconds from the time the condemned entered the room until he was turned over to the executioner, and 8 seconds from when he was turned over to the executioner until the executioner reported that the sentence had been carried out. I don't know if they were doing some kind of macabre time and motion, you know, study to see how efficient, how many people can you kill in a 24-hour period or what, but that gives you a sense of Nazism. If you've never been encountered Nazis before, that would be enough right there to give you a sense for their mentality.
Efficiency.
Yeah, efficiency and absolute cruelty.
Of cruelty. Helmut Huebner, at his trial, the verdict was passed. He said something like, "I have to die for no crime at all."
That's right.
He is firm in his convictions to the very end.
Yeah, he could see that he was doomed, and that, you know, being nice and asking for mercy was not going to get him anywhere. So he boldly stood up, and when they said, "Do any of you have any questions?" Carl and Rudy said no, but he stood up and said, "Look, you're judging me here, and you're going to execute me, but I haven't committed any kind of crime at all." Mm-hmm. But he said, "But you wait," and he said this to these judges in their blood red robes up there. The highest Nazi tribunal in Germany. "You wait," he said, "your turn will come." Earlier in the trial, they had asked him, they said, did you really believe when you wrote this junk that Germany would lose the war?" And he said, "Absolutely, don't you believe it?" And so he was, you know, he was a smart aleck in that sense, but I think it took enormous courage, but I think he knew that he was doomed and that he wanted to go out with a, you know, with his conscience clear and his conscience intact, and he didn't want to try to beg for clemency or whatever. There was a plea for clemency handed in, ironically, by the Hitler Youth themselves, because they thought, this doesn't make us look very good, you know, to have the Führer killing this 17-year-old kid who had been a member of the Hitler Youth. So they actually put in a plea for clemency, but it was denied.
Let's hear another clip from the film of Truth and Conviction is the film. It was shown recently on the USU campus. We're talking with Alan Kiel, Professor Emeritus of German Studies at Brigham Young University. He was on USU campus recently and gave a lecture titled Mormons and Nazis, The Case of Helmut Huebner, this teenage Mormon youth who confronted the Nazi regime along with a couple of friends. He was executed. The other two friends served time in prison camps and had some other things happened to them. Karl-Heinz Schnibbe and Rudy Volbe were their names. Here's a passage with Karl Schnibbe telling what happened to him a little bit after.
"And I came home in 49. One Saturday, my mom said, tomorrow we go in the organ concert. And there they played César Franck. Love it. Mendelssohn. Beautiful. I mean, all the Jewish composers, they were forbidden in Hitler Germany. And then it happened, right during the concert, I broke down, I started crying, and I cried and I cried. After that, the healing started very fast, you know. It was a long, long, hard road, but I made it."
"I don't think young people today can really understand what it was like in Nazi Germany. People were forced to make difficult decisions based on what information they had. For many of us, it was the time when patriotism and faith were at odds. It was a time when truth was treason. Helmut spoke for freedom in the best way he knew how. I don't regret what we did, but I don't blame those who didn't agree with our actions.
I guess I feel what Helmut said is true. God will be the proper judge of this matter.
That's Carl Stimme. He was part of the Hubner group, along with Helmut Hubner and Rudi Volba. They confronted, resisted the Nazi regime. Helmut Hubner was executed. So Carl Stimme and Rudi Volba ended up in the United States.
Yes.
And I think that Helmut Hubner's, a lot of his family...
His two half-brothers who survived the war came here as well.
And eventually, the remaining members of the group, Carl Stimme and Rudi Volba, were, and of course, all the group was honored back in Germany. And
yes, on many occasions, actually. The city of Hamburg particularly was good to them. I was invited one of those occasions in 1985. It was on the occasion of Helmut's, what would have been Helmut's 60th birthday. And they treated us very kindly, took us to all of those sites. It was a particularly cold winter, I remember, but they took us around to all these sites where they had been imprisoned. We got to meet the warden of this big prison. He told a story, interestingly enough, about how his predecessor had said that it was the prisoners who had saved his life on this trek through Poland. And it turned out that it was partly Carl who was a particularly good thief at stealing or organizing, as the Germans say, food on the trek. And he kept this Dr. Kruger almost single-handedly alive by his wits. And Kruger had passed that information on to his predecessor, who was now the warden of this prisoner. And so he was sitting in this Volkswagen bus waiting to go into the prison to stay warm. And this guy tells us this story. And Carl and I almost exploded with joy. That's exactly what happened. I was one of the ones who brought Dr. Kruger that food every night and saved him. He was not a Nazi, by the way, this Dr. Kruger. And Carl and Rudi both went to his denazification hearing and testified about what a good guy he had been and how he'd saved their lives on a number of occasions.
So you, Rudi Volba died.
Yeah, Rudi passed away a number of years ago, and I'm embarrassed that I can't remember it right now. He had cancer. These camps where they worked, Rudi was a mechanic, and there was a camp out in Grudentia, or they called it Graudenz, which is in Poland. It was an underground camp, and what they did is they took crashed, wrecked ME-109s, these Messerschmitt fighter planes, and they took them apart, cleaned the parts, and anything that was salvageable they used to reassemble, you know, new planes. And Rudi worked in this operation without a mask and without gloves, using very strong chemicals to strip the paint off these planes. And he knew that he was a walking time bomb as far as cancer was concerned because he'd been exposed to this. Carl was a painter and had been employed up in a safer job. He was up on top painting camouflage on the roof of this factory so that he didn't get exposed to that. So when Rudi passed away of cancer, really wasn't a big surprise to anybody, but it was a real loss because Rudi was a wonderful guy, a witty and just as open and as honest a guy. I could tell you, if we had time, lots of anecdotes about Rudi. But it actually does. Maybe I will slip this in. You know, when all of these Germans emigrated to Salt Lake City after the war, they brought this whole problem that you and I have been discussing with them. There were some who were still, you know, pretty sure that the Führer was a great thing and that somehow it had gone wrong, but, you know, they were still pretty... In fact, my colleagues at BYU told me before I joined the faculty that there had been a family of German immigrants in Canada whose children had come in succession to BYU as students. And it was disturbing because every April 20th, these kids would insist on bringing a birthday cake to class and ask the other students, would you like to join me in celebrating Adolf Hitler's birthday today? And of course, the other students were horrified at this, but this family just insisted on doing this. And there were people like that. So when this story became known and I began telling the story and I told a friend of mine named Tom Rogers about it, encouraged him to write a play, and he wrote a play about it, and it started hitting the newspapers, We started getting some pushback, the short version of the story is that unbeknownst to us, President Thomas Monson, now the president of the Mormon Church, but then an elder in the Quorum of the Twelve, was working very closely with the East German officials to try to get permission to have a temple built there, to get missionaries to be able to come in and out a little more freely and so forth. And he was concerned that this story would, you know, would mess his chances up, that somehow the word that, well, Mormons, they celebrate and encourage young people in totalitarian countries to stand up and cause trouble. So he asked us very kindly, he said, would you mind, I can't tell you why, but would you mind just delaying this for a little while? And of course, some people took that as an affront against academic freedom. Well, at some point, Rudy, sitting down with his stake president, getting his temple recommend renewed, and was asked, do you support the general authorities? He said, well, yeah, I do, but this Tom Monson guy's got me troubled because I'd like to know what's going on with him. So the stake president, a friend of Thomas Monson, said, well, hey, let's call Tom and see what. And so he sends him over to talk to Tom Monson. And Rudy said, no, I want to get something straight. Are you on the side of these old German emigres who are pro-Hitler? Or are you on our side? Whose side are you on? Brother Monson said, whoa, I'm on your side, brother. but there's something I can't tell you about. And then, of course, later when we found out about these agreements with Honecker, we looked back and said, aha, that's exactly what it was. And I must say that we've had a tailwind from the church hierarchy since then. Elder Packer reviewed this little film, liked it very much, he said, and in fact, even suggested the title for the little film, which is Truth and Conviction,
Conviction, yeah.
Which I thought was a much better title than the one we were throwing around at the time. So Rudy, just to give you a sense of what kind of a guy Rudy was, he was not afraid to march up to President Monson's office, and Elder Monson at the time, and say, hey, where are your sympathies here? And I think President Monson got a kind of a quick education in German history during this time. It was partly Rudy's doing. So I really admire Rudy, but unfortunately he was taken from us a little earlier. Carl, we had with us a little longer. I must say the Germans, the public affairs people of the Mormon Church in Frankfurt are in the habit of bringing somebody over on these even years. And now that Carl's gone, I'm kind of their only choice. So my wife and I were invited to come over, as I said, on the 70th anniversary, which was last fall in October, to give talks in various cities about this. And I'm really delighted that the public affairs people are trying to keep the story alive, because the implications for today are so important. And it's really important that young people and older people today follow Huebner. And I kind of list off the things. The key thing is to get good information. In those days, you couldn't in Germany. Today, we have kind of the same problem, but it's not because the government misinforms us. It's because we sort of choose, like, to go to one, you know, news source or another. We sort of line up and say, okay, I'm a conservative Republican, so I'm going to go listen to Glenn Beck. Or I'm not, so I'm going to go listen to Rachel Maddow or something like that. So we sort of pre-select now. But in either case, if the bottom line, if the final result is that we're not getting good information, we need to change that. And you may have to hold your nose and read the New York Times and the Washington Post and some of these papers that some people say are, you know, liberal slant and whatnot. Get over it, you know. Get your information where you can find the truth. The run-up to the Iraq War was a good case in point. You had Judith Miller writing articles for the New York Times, quoting unnamed sources in Washington that the Iraqis had these weapons and that they were working with al-Qaeda and so forth. And then Dick Cheney would step up to the microphone the next day and say, he was the unnamed source, of course, and he'd say, well, you don't have to take my word for it. You know, Judith Miller's reporting in the New York Times that this is the case. And so in 2000 and 10 years ago, 2003, when we had the run-up to the war, we had the same kind of problem, and that even affected the New York Times. But if you'd read the German newspapers at the time or been listening to the BBC, you'd have gotten a quite different view on it. So it's pretty clear that we need today great, strong sources of information. We cannot afford to be uninformed. That is deadly. Secondly, you got to be smart enough to be able to figure out what this stuff means, you know. And Helmut was smart enough to do that. And thirdly, you have to have the moral courage to act on it. Once you think you know the truth, and not just think you know the truth, but you really are confident that it's not just your bias speaking. Because there are lots of people who are just as enthusiastic as Helmut was, who were enthusiastic Nazis who thought, you know, this is the way to go. But that's what Gross was talking about. How come he knew that? How come I didn't know that? And I think it behooves us today to say to ourselves, how come this guy knows that, and how come I don't know that? When the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was passed back in 1964, 3 days after a really bogus attack in the Gulf of Tonkin, there was one attack 2 days before that in August, on August 2nd, where there was a PT boat a destroyer exchange, although it was pretty clear that we fired first. On the 7th of August, 64, the entire U.S. Congress passed this Gulf of Tonkin resolution, with the exception of two senators, Senator from Oregon and a Senator from Alaska. And they said, wait a minute, can we talk about this for another few days or something? And they said, no, we've got to pass this right now. And so they passed this thing and gave President Lyndon Johnson these powers to escalate the war, which he did, of course, which ended in the death and misery of millions of people. And it was a terrible setback for the United States. And those kinds of things we have to be more informed about and somehow become a little bit more like those people in 1989 in Leipzig, you know, who after this, I mean, they knew what the regime was like in East Germany by that time, and they were just not going to take it any longer. They had access to Western television. It was interesting. In Dresden, which is actually outside of the Western television range, that was called the Valley of the Uninformed. It was remarkable how much of this thing in 89 had to do with the fact that they had access to Western news. So it was, again, kind of analogous to Helmut having access to the BBC.
Finally, with Professor Kiel, I wonder, I don't know if you ever had occasion to have Rudi Volba or Carl Schnibbe talk to students. But if you didn't, maybe imagining this.
What
did they say? What were they anxious to pass on to the next generation from their experiences?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, we had them speak as often as we could. I had Carl come down a lot, and I always had to bribe him with pizza from the brick oven. That's what it was his favorite thing. Extra crispy, he said. But what they always, of course, they would tell their story, but what they said to the young students, and the students were resonated to this, you could see that, was, look, we don't know what your life's going to bring. We don't know what kind of political situation you're going to be in, but please be well-informed and be engaged. Don't be afraid, because your vote really counts. It's an irony of higher education that our students are so busy doing their homework and stuff that they don't do much with current events. I gave a lecture at BYU recently, and I asked them, polled them a little bit. I said, how many of you know this? How many know that? None of them knew anything, because they hadn't been paying attention to current events. And so they would, Carl and Rudi would always say, pay attention, read the newspaper, listen to television, but don't just go to the sources that, you know, agree with you and go to the no-spin zone or something. You go somewhere where you really get the facts, and then become engaged and become involved, because democracy, the democratic system, really is a fragile thing. It depends on us being educated and informed and willing to step forward and fight for a good cause. So they really, Carl came to the United States and said, he looked around at the time in the 50s and he said, oh my gosh, this is just like Germany, only the Jews here are black and we're treating them just like the German Nazis treated these black, or these Jews. So he became a real exponent of racial equality, Carl did. And he invited the students to look around for analogies and say, you know, look around. Is there somebody in your school who's being mistreated? It's odd, but the Helmut Huebner story has become a really big rallying thing in Germany against bullying, what the Germans call mobbing. And there's a Helmut Huebner school in Hamburg that has now, it's interesting, the word Helmut contains the word M-U-T, which means courage, and the word Huebner contains the word Üben, which means to practice. And so they print this Helmut with the Mut in bold type and the Huebner with the Üben in bold type, which means practice courage. And they have this contest at this school, who can be the most courageous in practicing courage in inventive and imaginative ways. And a lot of it's aimed at bullying, anti-bullying campaigns, and standing up for downtrodden minorities, and if you see somebody being mistreated. So this comes out in a lot of really interesting ways. It comes out in anti-homophobic initiatives in Germany. And so it was clear to me that Carl and Rudi wanted these kids to think broader. You know, don't just wait around till somebody like Hitler comes along, and then you can stand up like, you know, you're not going to be able to repeat exactly what Huebner did. Your situation is going to be different. I will tell you, as a footnote, that some years ago I got a call from the John Birch Society in Chicago. I was surprised because I didn't know they still existed. And they said, we want this Huebner story because this man, Barack Obama, who's a candidate for president, he's like Hitler. And we want our young people to go out and rally against this guy. And I said, are you people nuts? I said, Helmut Huber would turn over in his grave if I gave you the rights to publish his story in your thing. Anybody who says that Barack Obama or any American president is like Hitler is an idiot. They don't know anything about Hitler or Barack Obama to say that. I said, Huber would never have opposed Barack Obama. But he would have asked questions about, he would ask hard questions to Barack. He'd say, is this legal to send up a drone and shoot an American citizen and blow up him and his car and his kids and everybody else without any kind of judicial review? I think they would ask those kind of, Helmut would have asked that kind of hard question. But he certainly would have said, here's this guy who's just like Hitler. I mean, this is nuts. Nobody would say that in Germany. So wherever this comes up, the Hubner thing to do is to get the truth and then be courageous about speaking it, but also nonviolent. And I think it's very important, and I'm glad I got the chance to say that at the very end here. The thing that differentiates the Hubner group from, let's say, the Stauffenberg conspiracy, which I certainly do not condemn. I fully appreciate what they tried to do. I regret that, in fact, some of the Stauffenberg conspirators were executed in the very room, the same room at Plitzensee. They were hanged on piano wire, and the little hooks are still there on the beam that they installed just for that. And this was filmed so Hitler could see his enemies strangle themselves to death. But it's somehow a much more noble thing to, as we've learned from Martin Luther King and from Gandhi and others, that to approach these things in a nonviolent way. Violence from within would not have brought down the Nazi regime. Violence from within would certainly not have brought down the East German regime. They have lots more machine guns. I sometimes laugh at these guys who are collecting, assault rifles now, because they think that somehow the government is going to come for them. The Nazis were not worried about those kind of guys at all. Because why? Well, they had tanks. They had RPGs. Some guy with a pistol is no threat to the Nazi regime. So if you really believed that the American government was going to come after you, you'd certainly want to, you might as well collect Red Ryder BB guns as far as I'm concerned. But the point is that it's truth and boldness of action that is nonviolent in nature that has the potential to bring down these regimes. I'm watching this North Korea regime. I cannot believe this, this mouse that's roaring, as if you remember the old Peter Sellers movie about that country. But I can't believe that this kind of insanity could possibly go on much longer. At some point, somebody's going to say, this guy is nuts, and we've just got to do something about it. But I don't know much about the situation within. It's very tightly controlled. But I predict that someday that thing is just going to fall like a house of cards, and it won't be violence from within, I don't think, because the North Koreans don't have private weapons and so forth. And besides, if they did, how could they ever possibly get as many as the government has? But it's going to be something within, something intellectual, something courageous. And I hope it doesn't take some kind of outside intervention. I can't predict it, but since that's the most current event that, as we speak today, that we're kind of watching on the global horizon, I can't believe that there's that much difference between the North Koreans and the East Germans. Well, I really can. The East Germans were a kinder, gentler kind of communist than the North Koreans. Those guys go beyond everything that you can possibly imagine. But nobody would have guessed in 1989 or predicted that the regime would fall. Some critics of Tom Monson said, why don't you just wait a day or two and then that would have fallen. You wouldn't have had to shake hands with those nasty people, which I think was absurd. Well, nobody knew. Not even Thomas Monson knew that regime was going to fall. But suddenly, woof, it was gone.
We have been talking about the Hubner Group, a group of Mormon teenagers who confronted the Nazi regime in the early 1940s. Alan Keel is a Emeritus Professor of German Studies at Brigham Young University. He gave a presentation recently on the USU campus called Mormons and Nazis, The Case of Helmut Huber. Helmut Huber, Karl-Heinz Schnibbe, and Rudi Volba were those teenagers in the group. Karl-Heinz Schnibbe and Rudi Volba emigrated to United States, Utah, and Helmut Huebner was executed by the Nazi regime. He's one of the youngest opponents of the Third Reich to be executed. And you can find out more in Professor Kiel's books, several books written on the subject, one of which is When Truth Was Treason. And there's a movie, a documentary film on the subject called Truth and Conviction, directed by Matt Whitaker. This talk was a part of a symposium series on the Holocaust by USU Religious Studies program. Professor Kiel, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure, Tom. Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.